Shawna, thank you.
Thank you, Shawna.
It's interesting that I picked this one because it's actually what I'm, along the lines of what I'm thinking of doing for my thesis. It's interesting to know that it has a name.
Which was?
Interpretive Phenomenological Analysis, or IPA.
Very good, because it wouldn't have had a name 10 years ago, or even 8 years ago.
Right, well, I just saw that it was first developed in 1996 by Smith.
Jonathan Smith, who was a friend of mine, he started his career at Keele University. That was his first job, where I had my position. And he was the first person who got me passionately interested in qualitative research.
Oh.
Jonathan Smith. His PhD research was fascinating. He was one of the few people, I mean, imagine psychology at that time period, so we're talking about late 80s. And he managed to do a PhD at Oxford University that was the whole thesis was one case study of one pregnant woman in psychology. Now, that was not happening then. Nobody was doing anything like that. And he did it. And that...
What was it?
He was interested in how her sense of self changed over time from what she's like, you know,
cool.
Early on, you know, in her pregnancy, and then as she starts to become near the due date, and then after she has the baby, and he used a form of repertory grid analysis back then. He was interested in Kelly, which one of you is doing today? Repertory grid? No? Oh, okay, well, you guess what? Marty's doing that next week then. Marty will do that. But that's the technique he used, repertory grid, with her, and intensive qualitative interviewing. And he published that. And he was one of the first people. He actually published in the British Journal of Clinical Psychology, which was ever so difficult to get. Or medical psychology, I think it was psychology. This PhD work. And then went on to Sheffield University, where he is now. And has just been, just really, you know, through just reading like we're doing, and thinking about all these issues, and thinking about all these different ways people have grabbed their piece, he said, I want to do something that's phenomenological, but that has more method attached to it than just this narrative themes and concepts. I don't want something like discourse analysis. And so he captured this little area and made it his own. So it's kind of made a success story.
What was the P again? IP?
For our phenomenological
analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, Susan spoiled the surprise.
Oh, I know.
No, I'm kidding.
You don't surprise me. I didn't
hear it. I got you.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's that idea. It's that idea that you start with the individual, and you basically put yourself. You're trying to see the world from their perspective. You put yourself in their shoes, and you do this sort of really intensive kind of question asking, try and see how they're seeing the phenomenon that you're trying to study. So it's a data synthesis kind of thing, focusing on detailed experience and understanding of participants. So if you want to understand a group, the way it goes is that you have to fully, like, do this full analysis of each individual. And then once you understand the perspective of each individual, then you can go on and understand how, you know, how the phenomena sort of hang together and how it occurs within the group. Adopt the insider's perspective. It's double hermeneutic. This is a very interesting term. So the participant first is double, because there's double and then there's triple, I found out. So there's double.
I haven't seen triple.
Yes. So, triple just, yeah, it's quite mind-blowing.
You need double. That's even in Edward's account, I think, here.
I need to know what double hermeneutics.
Yeah. Okay, so it's double hermeneutic because, so first of all, you have the participant interpreting his or her life experiences. So in the case of Jonathan Smith interviewing the pregnant woman, you know, you'd...
Claire.
Sorry?
Her name was Claire.
Claire. So in that case, you know, he would ask her, well... you know, how do you feel about this, how do you feel about that? So she'd have to recall how she felt and what her impressions are. So she has to go through this process of interpreting her own feelings and her own impressions and capture it using certain types of words and certain types of phrases. And so that's the first step. That's the single hermeneutic. And then the second, the double, becomes when Jonathan Smith would interpret what Claire is saying and put it in a different context. Not a different context, but it's just that the way he would interpret and understand what she was saying. And then the, if you wanted to go into a triple hermeneutic, then what it would be is that people like us would look on Jonathan Smith's interpretation of Claire's experience. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, by the time you got to the triple part, it would be quite intense, I think.
I don't think you could get to a quadruple, though, really.
You could.
Sure.
TV, what we thought of what he thought.
Okay, there you go. I stand corrected. There's a quadruple.
Or we could make it cyclical, and then at that point take the interpretation back to Claire to then further interpret onto the interpretation.
That would be a double cycle.
Yeah.
That's
what
we call
here. So it'd be interesting to see, because then Claire could say, you know, whether they got it right.
It don't sound like a music event.
Okay,
sorry.
That's okay. So, something else that I came across but wasn't able to find any more on was the idea of an audit trail. So, this is the preferred quality control for IPA. It's called an audit trail. So, basically, having an external member or members sort of checking or surveying the data, it wouldn't necessarily work because they can't actually put themselves into the context. They can't understand the context. So I just took this right from the website where I found it. Actually, IPA, there wasn't a lot on it, period.
No,
so.
Because it's new, and I only know of 5 publications that have used the method, but there's probably more now out there.
There's one through UBC that I found on dementia, and then it's in nursing journals a lot.
They've really picked up on it. You can see why.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful technique for clinical.
So then is it typically for just one subject? It's like a small sample, or you can use it for a larger sample?
Well, what I gathered is that you can use it for a larger sample, but you have to start with the individual. So if I want to understand how... Like in my case, so I want to understand gifted learning disabled students. Well, to understand, if I find a group of them, let's say I find like 3 or 4 kids, which is what I'm hoping to do, I would have to start by looking at one of them. I have to look at them individually and go through this whole process and really understand how they're thinking and what their impressions are, how they understand their concept of self and how they understand the way they're treated and their, you know, the
and
whole
then you
thing.
Could have a comparative case
study. So I do it for all
of
them and then
3.
See how they...
Okay.
Yeah. Is that...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So it works best for... I mean, it's case... It's suited to case study, but then you can string other participants along in a comparative way. Definitely. I think it would get very difficult to manage with really large samples.
Yes. I would imagine. Okay. So there's four elements to IPA. So first is receptiveness, where you have to recognize your personal response. Orientating and bracketing, where you document the response, noting what is unique to the experience. Grounding and interpretive analysis. I'm just going slowly, if I can hear everyone scribbling. So grounding and interpretive analysis, this is where, and again, I'd like to see more of this because it sounds really interesting. So basically you make a list with 2 columns. So you list observations, 1 column, and then in the next column you list interpretive meanings. So it sets up a self-reflexive dialogue, it was called. Mm-hmm. So it sort of helps you keep track of what your impressions are and sort of how it compares. And
it helps you keep... try to separate a little bit the burnt toast phenomenon. So it helps you try to think, just what am I describing before I'm interpreting? You know, it's that notion. In fact, very much like what we're going to do today and what we're going to be doing next week. I brought a slide, which is this. But having said that, you don't need to start with this column or this first, you can start with an interpretation, but recognize you're immediately interpreting something. Like, that sounds so sad, you know, to me. But then you have to say, well, what in it is making it sound sad to me? Mm-hmm. Then you have to go back and say, what was it? Like, did the person actually say I'm sad? That would do it. Or was it not that transparent? You know, was it much more difficult for me to say, how did I get that? Mm-hmm.
So does that then mean that it's not from, say, transcendental phenomenology, but it's more coming from existential?
Good question. I think that by the time you're at this level, neither one of the those separations is going to make a difference.
So this is a whole new subset, say, of phenomenology?
It's just phenomenology. I mean, if you think about it, philosophically they separated out the two branches, okay, because Husserl had a particular reason for wanting to develop phenomenology, which wasn't necessarily to create a method of analysis like this.
Right.
And Heidegger similarly had a particular reason, which is that he wanted to make phenomenology particularly concerned with existential issues, okay, about what it was to be something. Now, so I think that those are philosophical stances on phenomenology that are important in their distinction, but when you get down to this level, you're thinking much more about taking what has been said now as the, for lack of a better word, the actual object of study. Okay, so you don't need to think phenomenologically very much about it anymore. You've already accepted that it's come from a person's own account of their experience. Full stop, right? So you've got a piece of phenomenology in front of you. And now I'm trying to say, what would you do with it? And that was what you're saying. IPA is a method, right? So it's saying, we've already taken the overview that we have phenomenology here. We have someone's experience reported to us as they perceive it to be. Now we're trying to do something with it and interpret it. And interpreting it, we're going to make two columns, or we're going to think about these two distinctions, okay? And that you can work from either way, back to where you're getting a sense of something or from a description of something forward to what it means. Yeah. We'll give some examples tonight when we do it.
I'm just trying to situate it. That's all, like where it kind of sits within like the method that we were looking at in Spinelli. So it's an alternate method, but it doesn't actually look at the same kind of thing because you're looking at someone else's interpretation. So you're not, it's the one we looked at Spinelli is you're making an observation, you as the investigator are making your own observations. This one is the participant is making their observations and then you're working from that. Is that the kind of...
I think I know what you mean, because in the readings that's what I sort of came across too, is this kind of, like you imagine that it's inevitable that your existences are going to mesh because of, you know, just because you're interacting, but there's a sort of process where you're trying to tease out whose stuff is whose in the interview process. But so that's what I was actually going to ask about that is, you know, at what point do you accept that you're going to sort of mesh or play off each other? And so how do you sort of tease out whose phenomenon is whose?
Kind of what the bracketing is for? Or
yeah.
The bracketing helps. But what particularly helps is... I mean, you know that what you're starting with is the person's subjective experience. So the subjectivity is there from them. You know that your reading of the account will be an interpretive layer on top of that again. So what you're starting with, the description, what you're trying to stay close to is the description, which is the person's subjective experience. Okay, that's what you're starting with. Your layer of developing the interpretive meanings, the concepts, I usually think of them as themes and concepts, just helps me separate them, but this is your layer now of your subjectivity coming into play. Now, what you're saying is, how do you know how much of it is, what if there's a mesh between what's said and your interpretation of it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm thinking of, too, is like, I notice this sort of in my everyday life. This is what worries me about interviewing, is because, like, I find that depending on who I talk to, very different details, well, I'm sure everyone finds that very different details emerge.
Yeah.
You know, based on what you're, you know, how you understand the situation. Like, to one person, you'll sort of let it flow, and you know, all the ire and angst that you felt, and for another person, you know, you'll sort of play it down and, you know, put on a happy face kind of thing. No, it's not so bad. And so that's what I wonder about, is if I would, you know, somehow cause my participant to sort of gloss over how they really feel, or on the other hand, if I make them particularly upset or particularly angry, or, I mean,
okay.
But that's it. I mean, you can never, there is no truth. It's just, it's always.
That's right. Okay.
Very overwhelming.
Okay, now, it is hard. Let me try to be clear. The way you just framed what you just said is a level before this. You're back at the interview stage. You've said, you know, you can influence the way someone says something. Yes, the interview in itself is a social interaction. And so as such, it's a whole, the data that gets produced, but remember, you're not doing anything with the interview until it's transcribed, right? Then it becomes data, right? Once it's transcribed, data that you work from. So the transcribed information is already a subjective experience. It's a subjective experience from the social encounter of the interview. So all those things you've said, you know, what went on in the interview, whether you know, the person got upset, whether you said this question, whether you, for example, you can look at interviews and you can see certain interesting things that happen in them. A person may be rattling off something that happened to them the other day, and then someone will come up with something like the word, like in the Diana example I gave you last week, like the word daunting, where she'd never used that. You know, she'd be going on for a few minutes and never used the word daunting. The interviewer uses the word daunting. Mm-hmm. And then what do we see 2 minutes later? She's using the word daunting again. Now, can we say, well, she always maybe would have said daunting anyway. That's probably part of her vocabulary. She would have used it for that particular way of describing her experience. Or was that put into her head by the interviewer? Because the interviewer used that word and gave her that idea of bringing in daunting. That's what you're getting at, right? How can we tease out those things? Well, that's the reflexive analysis. The reflexive analysis helps you question those things. It doesn't change them. It doesn't mean they're not, they're still there. She still said daunting. That's still my data. Okay? So it depends. So if you get bogged down with that side of it, you're not going to get to your research question, are you? So that's why I tend to call reflexivity section, a separate section in the paper, reflexive analysis, where you do all that work, where your field notes or what you've called your audit trail, you pull from your audit trail to question, to bring more transparent where some of these meanings might come from. For example, when I gave you my paper on OCD paper, okay, one of my reflexive analysis components was to talk about how articulate this particular woman is. Because that makes a big difference. And, you know, a less articulate person or someone less in tune with their illness would not be able to tell me the kinds of things that she did, would not have perhaps been so forthcoming. So that's part of my thinking about how I was able to pull out so much from this woman. You know, I wasn't saying it's because I'm a great interviewer. I was saying it's because, you know, I know it's because she had already given this a lot of thought. There'd been a lot of reflexive work on her part, you know, thinking about her illness before she even came to the interview situation. So that became, but that had nothing to do with my research question or my analysis. That was the layer that I add to it that helps to say why I came to the conclusions I've come to and what maybe influenced them in the first place. But if we stop to worry about those, we'd never get any research done. So try to leave that layer as it's got to be there and it's important. But if it can also, you know, if you try to anticipate too much those issues and go for what you, and have some idea in your head that there could be a perfect interview or a better interview or a, then you'll never have, you know, meaningful data. The other way to set up yourself that I find really helps me in qualitative research is that you can always go back. Try to never limit yourself to one interview and one piece of data to work from. The more you go back, the more confident you get, the more that the interpretations you're making are consistent with what the person's been talking about all along, you know, or not even as consistent, but just that you're able to give, it increases your own confidence, I think, is what I'm trying to say the most. The more often you can go back, even if you don't need to, sometimes you won't go back, but try to set up your interview so you can.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by go back to the same person and ask more questions, clarify?
Yeah.
Okay, that's...
Yeah.
So with a case study then, you could, it would be completely fair to go back to things that had been said before and clarify, and you could even do it on different occasions.
Absolutely. I would say that it's crucial, important. And if you want the added validity of your research being really situated in the person's as a co-researcher, you know, in that more collaborative notion of research that's really important these days, then you want to work with someone and take back your interpretation. So you want to do like an interview and then pull out some themes from this process, take them back to the person and say, you know, this is what I saw in the kinds of the way I read into the kinds of things that you were saying. You know, what do you make of that? You know, and let them contradict you or let them agree, and then but take that, because that's all part of it. And then you work from that layer too, and that's really, really good, especially if they contradict what your interpretation is, because they give you so much insight into, you know, they may be contradicting it for reasons that have nothing to do with what they actually said. It may be that they're contradicting it because when faced with that, it makes them appear to themselves in a way that they didn't need to appear. Like holding a mirror up to yourself, right? So for some examples, I'll give you a concrete example. This happened a lot when we were interviewing African-American young people in the U.S. What example I'll draw from for you now is, okay, a typical example that I would have would be a young African-American woman, grade 11 I'm talking about, okay, saying that something like, well, I'm not racist or anything. You know, I mean, I think everybody should just hang with their own. And, you know, it's just like I don't really think about white people. I don't really, you know, I'm not racist. I just don't really think about them. And I just think that, you know, people want to hang with their own. So that's the way it should be. Okay? All right. Now, that's almost exactly the kind of, you know, thing we might get. So in looking at that, if I was in analyzing that, of course, I'd have to be very careful in this case. I don't know if I do it, but if I was to take that then back, doing this process and saying, okay, one of the interpretations or concepts I might come up with from that is this strong sense to for social credibility with me, the interviewer, you know, trying to say, you know, I'm not a bad person, I'm not a racist, but at the same time, but she needs to do that discursive work, we call it, establish that. Because what she ultimately wants to say is, but I prefer to be with my black friends. I don't mix. And she hasn't gone on to tell us why. We can't assume, we can't overinterpret, we can't read between the lines things that aren't there to tell us anything more than that. But there's definitely in her mind a legitimatization being given to the separation of black and white. She's even said in it, people like to hang with their own. Meaning, you know, that's the way the world is. I didn't make that up. It's not coming from me. Do you see? There's a lot of interesting work going on. Now, if I brought that back and to her and then held that up for her as a kind of, is that what you meant to be saying, that sort of thing, you can just imagine any engagement with that material at that point is just going to really, really add to the analysis. Even if it was a case of, well, I don't see what you're saying there. I don't think that's racist, saying people are different. You see, you know, any kind of further work she might do is only going to help increase my confidence of my overall interpretation, even if it's a contradictory piece that comes from the person. Okay, because we're full of contradictions. Or even if, what's even more fascinating, let me put it to you this way, and this is what happened with Claire, too, and with some of my work that I've done. When you bring it back to somebody, you actually see, right before your eyes, working out of a person's identity, you know, an element of it. That's absolutely fascinating. They're actually doing it right in front of you. They're actually, you know, constructing who they are in relation to that mirror you just held up. So they might say, well, Emma, in my paper, for example, said, gee, she said, it sounds like, she said, do you think that I'm, it's like my religion? You know? She said this OCD, do you think it's like, she said that to me, like, you know, like a big light bulb just gone off over her head. You know, and that was during a taking back session. I brought back her initial and I said, you seem to be equating these, you know, this kind of your deep religious upbringing with this idea about the control over your life that's happened, da, 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 da. And then she just, without me even mentioning the connection, she made it. And I had it on tape. And it's just that's an amazing moment because, you know, you've actually watched somebody do that work right there in front of you. Does that make sense? And I think that, you know, that if you could ever get a strong, I'm just trying to have my own experience too, that I can't think of a stronger way to justify this kind of method and to make you feel a lot better about the conclusions you'll draw from it.
When you talk about collaborative research, in that sense, you were referring to taking back and working, collaborating with the
one way. Yeah.
And would collaborative research be, you know, same as you and I collaborated?
Yeah, that collaborative research, I mean, a co-researcher can be the participant themselves, which a lot of feminist researchers, of course, have advocated as being important that we, you know, particularly in relation to no longer placing participants as the object of study, but saying, you know, these are thinking, talking human beings who can be equally part of a research process, right? So giving them equal status. So it was more an issue about hegemonic power relationships that come from feminist research that said we want to make our participants equal, co-researchers. But co-researcher in the other collaborative sense of doing, you know, team, what you call team analysis, or just one other person on the team, whatever, is another way to do that same kind of work.
So you think the term collaborative research, though, is more accurate with the participant and the researcher?
It would be more accurate, yes, but it's not the norm. It's not used that way in the norm, right? In the field of academia, we think of a collaborative work as between our other researchers. And
I mean, something usually that
that's why I phrased it, that it comes from feminist kind of issue of dealing with power, that we try to make change the word collaborative to mean what it should mean in terms of the participants. Go ahead.
What I was saying was something that usually happens, especially in the business literature, is most journal articles are by two or three different authors, and that's usually how the
collaborative. Absolutely. So maybe the word co-researcher is also a way to get around that. That's what I tend to see it, as a co-researcher being the participant worked as a co-researcher in this process of looking at the data. Okay. All right. So that's it's a tricky one. This thing here, to me, is the crucial component. If you can do this and do it well, then you can do almost any type of qualitative analysis. Okay. You can get to almost any type. And that's why I'm so glad, Shauna, that you started actually with IPA tonight, because it's the one most closely rooted to what we've been reading so far with this finale. It's the one that's giving us that foundational notion. And it's the one that really was the very first, you know, if you look back to what was qualitative research in its infancy being, you know, what was there and being done was all based on grounded theory. You've heard of that probably. Even quantitative scientists have heard of grounded theory, okay, which was just the notion of an emergent theory rather than having a theory and then creating hypotheses from it and then testing them, right? That your data or your theories were grounded in the data. And so that very basic process was about taking your data and developing themes, okay? Some people now call it a thematic analysis. So at its very, very basic level, a thematic analysis could stop here. And this is where I think the divide between qualitative research with a positivist hat on stops, which means you just categorize this. So you have a lot of talk or text that describes a phenomenon, you categorize it based on the descriptions, and people call that qualitative data. And people use grounded theory to then develop a theory from that. Okay. Right. And it exists. We all know it does. And that's where most people will stop with study of qualitative research. So what we're doing is we're saying, okay, but that isn't qualitative research within the alternate paradigm or new paradigm. with that phenomenological epistemology or whatever, or the ontology of epistemologies we've been talking about, have shifted and changed. And now if we want to move on to that kind of research, we've got to go to this layer at least. Okay. And it can get many more layers of complication after that. But if you can get to this at the end of the course with looking at a piece of text, then you've made that shift.
And then the arrow goes both directions. Does that refer to a cyclical sort of, you go back and forth, or?
It means that, but it also means that you can sometimes, when you're looking at a piece of text, you start from here. Okay, because that's your intuitive level. Let's say, for example, you get, like I gave you before, the narrative tone that I got from reading into that African-American young woman's account was a narrative tone. I might say, well, geez, you know, I get this real narrative tone from her in my reading that she's defensive. Okay, so that's my interpretive layer. Now I have to say, but she didn't actually say to me, I am a defensive young woman, did she? So that would be easy. So I have to now go back to the data and say, what is it in the data that's giving me that sense? And sometimes you can't find it. Sometimes it's not there. And then, reflexive analysis, you make those notes. You say, I have this, but I cannot confirm this through anything that's in the data.
And you had said before that you can't, once it's written down, that you can't refer to tone of voice and gesture.
Well, you can if that's the kind of research you want to do. But you've added another layer again that you're going to have an audit trail for, and that's got that transparency and openness to being, so that your interpretations could be valid, considered valid. You see what I mean? So if you take notes about that interpretive tone, if you have video data, you want to use video observation as well about the person and gestures, and there's ways to transcribe it to that degree of depth. In fact, that's what conversation analysis, which is the only technique I've ever used, they use a form of transcription that is so detailed that way. So they make inflections, they make every gesture of speech in the transcription. I've never used that because I find that just completely boggles me to go to that level.
The research that I'm going to be doing is using a piece of software that's developed that allows you to do that. So say you've got the video of an interaction or an interview, you'll have a transcription, and then you have these little tracks that go beneath it that you can put layers, and you can start to look at, and you've got the audio waveform, and you can start to look at intonation and volume, and you can look at different behaviors, but it gets really...
And you have to step back again.
It's so tedious.
Well, it's so tedious.
Oh, yeah.
But then you've got to step back again and ask yourself, why would I need that? What am I doing? What added information is that going to give me? What credibility is that going to lend to my research? What kind of questions am I asking that would possibly necessitate?
The only thing I can think of
that kind of
with thing. That is, and this is from talking to a friend of mine who was in counseling, and one of the major themes that she was studying at the time was how people's gestures and tone of voice completely contradict what they're actually saying.
Absolutely. Well, then of course.
So I'm thinking of in terms of those sorts of gestures or tones of voice that might be more transparent. It's not sort of, you know, as if, you know, their finger slightly moved, da da da. But, you know, if you have someone who's talking about their father's funeral and how traumatic it was, and they're laughing and, you know, sort of talking with their hands behind their head or something, that, you know, that's something you really should make note of.
Absolutely. And you have that potential to have notes of that. It just doesn't mean that every single thing you take note of is going to be important in your analysis.
You'd have to sift.
At that particular, for the particular question you're addressing. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So that's why I'm saying, why do it? I mean, there's two schools of thought. One school that when I was doing my PhD, my supervisor was a school of thought that was, you can never collect too much data. It doesn't matter if you don't use it all. Just collect it. So you've got it, and, you know. And I can tell you right now that, you know, 12 years on, I am completely not of that school of data of thought anymore, because I realized that by doing that, it enables, particularly enables students to have not thought through what they really want to do well. And it might and that you'll end up with a piece of work that is just not tight, and not, you know, you'll probably get your PhD, whichever way you do it. Okay? You will. Because they'll just give you credit for all that data you collected. That's not that bad. But you do get credit for that, believe it or not. Some people put a lot of value by that. But for developing yourself and for having potential for publications later, I think it does a real discredit, disservice, because the student spends so much time sifting through stuff that you'll never use, and you will never use it. It'll sit in a filing cabinet, you'll keep it for 10 years, and then eventually you'll move house with it one too many times and you'll throw it away. But yeah, you'll never use it. So try to work with what you get really, really well. Is what my advice would be for qualitative research, okay? For quantitative.
You mentioned that a lot of research doesn't go beyond
a lot of what's called qualitative.
So when we're reading research, is that something we should watch for?
You'll know it now immediately. Yeah. You'll know when a piece of research is and you'll know it, you know already, usually it's just by the journals they're published in, but if it's, you know, real qualitative, sorry to use that word, or you know, pseudo qualitative, which is what I think is.
So if you're reading stuff that didn't have the concepts developed, you would have a feeling kind of what? You'd have these questions, right?
Well, you'd have the same feeling you'd have if you just read an ANOVA table.
A what?
Analysis of variance table, a statistical analysis. You have the same feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You wouldn't believe it. Maybe so what? Maybe, oh, okay, they asked this question and they got exactly what they thought they'd get, and, you know, and it's significant, amazing,
mm-hmm.
right? But what we still don't know is blah, 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 right?
It probably wouldn't have that much meaning to you, right?
Well, you
could have developed.
It's all about what your assumption, set of your epistemology that you're working from would bring to it. Think, for example, the number of times it happens. I mean, if people are saying, okay, we counted the number of times that these gestures were made in counseling, and we found that women did it far more than men, and we found that those are the blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's your statistical side. Then we looked at their talk, and we further categorized their talk into talk that was positive when gestures and talk that was negative when gestures were being used. I'm just making it up, but you get the idea, right? And based on that, we found that women gave a higher proportion of positive gesturing than, you know, men who gave a higher proportion of negative gesturing, even though women overall give more gesturing. This is what you can get, you see? At this level, descriptive level. Okay? Some people do say, yeah, so what to that, I'm afraid, but other people don't, and people still value this as science and as really important stuff. So I'm not, you know, here to make up your mind for you on that, but I'm here to tell you my opinions, which I do, and I don't disguise them. But at the same time, this is why we moved to a new paradigm. Because we couldn't get any further than that. And think of it this way, if you looked at the psychology journals, you know, for 50 years, the first 50 years, if you were, you know, an alien who came down from another planet, you would think that human beings didn't talk. There's absolutely no indication that there was, that the talk was an element of human beings' behavior, because it was just ignored.
Yeah.
Or if it was used, it was categorized and then turned into numbers and turned into some kind of statistical table of how many times people said this or that or the other. So it became really problematic when people started to want to know more things, like, you know, more probing things about the self and the mind. But what was interesting is education, although it was using the methods of psychology, it broke with that tradition far sooner, you know, because it had an ability to be influenced by sociology, you know, economics, you know, people, paths that were using some alternative thought, right? So I think that that's why we're sort of lucky to be in education, because and not lucky at the same time, because we get this mismatch of everything that we can draw on and accumulate, but at the same time we don't have a method, do we? There's no education method per se. So psychology was slow to catch up, but in the same way, we can thank psychology in terms of qualitative research because it took the reins and has developed real methods that educationalists can now use. Okay, so that's where we're going to go, that side of it. And I'm going to get back to you finishing.
I just have one more.
It was important. Actually, it was my lecture for tonight, so I just. If you don't mind it being out of order, I just gave it to you earlier, you know, because it was the starting point for the lecture. So.
Well, there's just one more point I had, the last of the four that I mentioned. The last is synthesis, so where you look for shared interpretations within the context.
Can you repeat number two again, actually?
Sorry, yeah. Orientating and bracketing, or orienting and bracketing.
So that's back to our Husserl's
assumption. I guess we don't actually need to take notes because we're all going to email each other all the papers. I mean,
yeah, we get these.
But it helps to make notes.
I find it helps to make notes too. I feel naked with them.
It helps me to be able to go back if I want to and make connections in the class. Like, I remember when you. But that audit trail that you talked about, that'll become increasingly clear. It's kind of the equivalent. For IPA, a field notes in observational field studies would be, but it's much more focused on the process than it is on the phenomenon. So that's what it's about. But I like that very, very, very much as a way to do this. So good. So you'll probably want to find a good IPA paper for your review paper here, so you can actually get look critically at it now. Okay, well done, you. That was really good. It was a very hard one because it's new.
Well, there's one website that I found that sort of explored and contrasted. It was a really good website. I was actually thinking of emailing it to everyone because it has a whole list of qualitative.
Wonderful. Please do.
Yeah.
Actually, you prompted me I wanted to say that you found that wonderful website of that course. In Australia or New Zealand, that if you could email that website to the class. The reason being is that it not only did it have a nice concept, terms defined list, but it has an outstanding, far superior to mine.
I think I ran the reference list. Actually.
She has a great reference list. It's really, really long, but it's got websites, it's got everything all put into sections. Yeah, you know, it's really good.
That's the one.
Yeah, I love that because I learned so much from this kind of thing. Like, just I wouldn't have. I just liked your references because it's useful.
I thought it was useful. I noticed there's something. Oh yeah.
We have some.
Yeah. I just went. What hermeneutics again? I'm looking here. But it does have some interesting ones. It's so
wonderful. Good.
Can I just ask one? Have you come across dynamic assessment?
No.
Okay. That's sort of like the IPA version of like assessment of cognitive processes. So
okay.
I was just wondering if you had come across it or not.
No, and in fact, but there's people are always coming up with, like I say, new pieces of the pie. Dynamic assessment. Let me just see if Edward refers to it at all.
It's interesting because I read one article about it that really illustrates this whole process where you can.
Yeah, but now that you're accumulating this knowledge, you can look at the epistemology that these things are coming from because that'll tell you a lot about whether you want to use the method.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, here in Edward's book, which is. That's a lot of the cognitive processes that you would have been interested in. This one? Yeah,
right.
Yeah, different. Well, it depends which. But from what you've told me about, there may be things in here that are interesting. But you can certainly look at the book and pass it to you after.
Great, thanks.
There are. There's less attention given. I'm just looking at the index to give an idea here. To some issues. That you would find in more narrative kind of analysis, although he's pretty good at words at being quite inclusive. But I'm just trying to see. For example, hermeneutics doesn't appear in the index from here, either. It doesn't mean much because the indexes are sometimes bad, but you can get an idea about how, where people will draw on, what they're drawing on. Right, okay. See, this his approach, I can already tell you the school that he's coming from is connected much more to someone called Billick in the UK. His research is about rhetoric. He's really interested in rhetorical analysis, which is another kind of... So there's so many. And the philosophy with the rhetorical analysis would be looking more at Moscovici's social representations and Wittgenstein's or philosophical investigations, notions about language and language games. So if you start to look at methods critically and think, well, which one do I want to use and why? Make sure you can get back up to their epistemological, ontological roots. And you'll know whether that's going to be something you want to deal with. Okay.